Welcome back, everyone, to The Deep Dive. We're diving into United States v. Harris, a Supreme Court case from 1883.
Definitely a significant one.
Huge implications for federal power, especially when it comes to dealing with racial violence during the Reconstruction era. It all started with this horrific incident down in Tennessee.
Oh, yeah.
A sheriff leading a mob to beat black prisoners.
Brutally.
Tragically, one of them actually died.
Yeah.
So it really raises this question of, you know, did Congress overstep its boundaries by trying to punish this act? Or was it, like, absolutely necessary to protect those equal rights that were supposed to be guaranteed after the Civil War?
You've got it. A real constitutional conflict brewing there. And the implications of the court's decision, man, they're still felt today. We need to break down the constitutional arguments to get the full picture, though.
Okay, so let's unpack it. We're dealing with a couple of key amendments here, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The 13th, the 14th, and importantly, why the 15th Amendment isn't really a player in this case.
All right, so quick recap for anyone who needs it. 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. 14th, equal protection and due process. 15th, protecting the right to vote.
Yeah.
So how did these play into Harris?
All right, so the court, they took a very narrow view of the 13th Amendment, you see. They said, yeah, Congress, they can ban the badges and incidents of slavery.
Right.
But this mob violence, not directly tied to that legacy, they saw it basically as like any other regular crime.
Hmm. That's really interesting because, you know, an act of racial violence like that seems like it'd be a pretty clear badge or incident of slavery.
Yeah, it's not so obvious, right? It's just not how they saw it back then.
Okay, so then what about the 14th Amendment? You'd think equal protection would be a slam dunk here.
Oh, you would think so, right. But this is where things get really complicated. See, the court said the 14th Amendment only applies to what the government does state action, not what private individuals do. So they're saying this mob, that's a private matter. The feds can't really step in under the 14th.
So wait, hold on. I'm trying to get this straight. They're saying if a group of people, let's say, decides to attack someone because of their race, as long as they're not, like, officially working for the government, the federal government can't do anything.
Well, that's kind of the logic they used in Harris. They looked at the law Congress passed, making it a crime to conspire to deprive people of their rights. And they said, nope, too broad. They thought it was going after private citizens, not just state officials or policies.
So basically, Congress was overreaching.
That's how the court saw it. It's where that whole state action doctrine really kicks in.
Yeah, and that doctrine still matters a ton in civil rights law even today.
Oh, absolutely.
But I mean, doesn't that create like this huge gap in the government's ability to actually protect people?
It did. It set a precedent that, well, let's just say it really shaped things moving forward.
So they basically opened this loophole where people could just, you know, do horrible things. And as long as they weren't technically acting on behalf of the state, there'd be no federal consequences.
Yeah, it's one way to look at it, unfortunately.
And what about the 15th Amendment? Was that considered at all?
Not really. 15th Amendment is all about voting rights.
Right.
This case, it was about violence, not the right to vote. So the court said it didn't apply.
So they were really narrowing the scope of these Reconstruction amendments, huh? Especially in a case as awful as this.
Yeah, it's crucial to think about the time period. You know, this was Reconstruction, things were changing, but there was a lot of pushback, a lot of retrenchment happening.
Like the government kind of backing away from its commitments.
Exactly. And this decision, well, it basically tied their hands even more when it came to dealing with racial violence.
Right.
Really shows you how much legal decisions are tied to what's going on in society at the time. This wasn't just like an abstract legal debate, it had real consequences for people on the ground.
Oh, absolutely. Harris, along with another case from the same year, the civil rights cases, which tackled public accommodation laws, they both made it way harder to fight racial discrimination, especially in the South. So what happened after Harris? What were the long-term effects of this decision?
Well, Harris really had a ripple effect, especially when we talk about lynching.
Right, those horrific extrajudicial killings, often by mobs. The terror that black communities, especially in the South, faced.
Exactly. And Harris, it basically gutted the federal government's ability to really prosecute these racially motivated acts of terror. I mean, think about it. It took until 2022, over 140 years later, for Congress to finally pass the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act, making lynching a federal hate crime.
It's mind-boggling. Over a century to close that loophole from Harris. What were the factors that contributed to such a long delay?
It's a long and complicated story, a lot of political forces at play. You had Southern Democrats in Congress often obstructing anti-lynching legislation.
Right.
Plus, this idea that lynching was a local problem, you know, a state's rights issue, not for the federal government to get involved in.
Which kind of echoes the arguments we saw in Harris itself.
Exactly. That decision cast a long shadow over the fight against racial violence.
So Harris really closed off one avenue for the federal government to protect Black Americans. What did civil rights advocates do? Did they just throw up their hands?
No, not at all. Right. They had to get creative. So with the 13th and 14th Amendments being interpreted so narrowly, they turned to other parts of the Constitution, like the Commerce Clause.
The Commerce Clause, the one about Congress regulating interstate commerce. That seems like a pretty roundabout way to address racial discrimination.
It was, but it was also pretty ingenious. They argued that businesses discriminating against Black customers were, in effect, messing with interstate commerce.
I see.
So they could use the Commerce Clause to, like, indirectly target racial discrimination.
And did this strategy actually work?
It did, in some pretty big cases. You've got Heart of Atlanta Motel in 1964, where the Supreme Court upheld the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which banned racial discrimination in public accommodations, saying that it hindered interstate travel.
So they found a way around Harris, at least to some extent.
Yeah, but the push for a broader understanding of the 13th Amendment, that didn't go away. And finally, in 1968, in Jones v. Alfred H. Mayer Company, the Supreme Court actually revisited the 13th Amendment. They expanded its reach to fight against private discrimination in housing.
So it's been this long, complicated battle over what those Reconstruction Amendments can really do when it comes to tackling racial discrimination.
Absolutely. And United States v. Harris, it's a turning point in that story. It shows just how tough it's been to interpret and apply these amendments to actually protect everyone's rights.
We've talked about the legal and historical context of Harris, but what about the public reaction back in 1883? You said it was a time of a lot of change.
Oh yeah, divided reactions for sure. Split pretty cleanly along racial and political lines, as you can imagine.
This makes sense.
White Southerners, especially those who are against Reconstruction, saw Harris as a win.
A win for states' rights.
Exactly. A way to push back against federal power, protect their way of life.
Basically keep things as they were.
Pretty much. But for Black Americans, for their allies, Harris was devastating,
yeah.
A real step backward. The government was retreating from protecting their newly won rights. You saw outrage, disappointment in Black newspapers, civil rights groups.
I can only imagine.
It felt like a betrayal of the promises of equality from those Reconstruction Amendments.
Did it spark any kind of movement to overturn it or challenge it?
There were calls for action, for Congress to pass new laws to address the gaps left by Harris.
Oh.
But as we said, federal anti-lynching legislation, that took over a century.
A long wait for justice. It really underscores the power dynamics, the systemic barriers at play.
It does. The legacy of Harris is a reminder of how fragile legal protections can be, especially during times of upheaval. And it shows that the pursuit of justice, it's not a one-and-done thing. It takes constant effort, strategic action, and the courage to challenge the status quo.
We've covered a lot of ground with United States v. Harris. The history, the legal arguments, the devastating impact it had on stopping racial violence. But like with anything complicated, there's always more than one side to the story. Maybe we should dig a bit deeper and look at some different viewpoints.
You're absolutely right. History and legal interpretation, they're hardly ever black and white. And exploring those nuances can really help us understand the case better.
Where do we even begin?
Well, one way is to look at the dissenting opinions in Harris. The Supreme Court wasn't all on the same page, and those voices who disagreed, they offer valuable insights. Justice Harlan, for instance, he really went against the grain, saying the court shouldn't have even heard the case.
Right, we touched on that earlier. He had some major issues with how the majority saw things. Can you tell us more about his concerns?
Sure. Harlan believed that the way the case got to the Supreme Court through what's called a certificate of division was messed up. He said it didn't lay out the legal questions clearly enough, so the court should have just stayed out of it.
It's more of a procedural issue, not that he disagreed with the actual content of the case.
It's not that simple. While his dissent in Harris was about procedure, later on he became a champion for a much broader view of the 14th Amendment. His famous dissent in Plessy v. Ferguson is a perfect example.
Plessy, the one that upheld separate but equal segregation.
Yeah.
Harlan was the only one who dissented, famously saying the Constitution is colorblind.
Exactly. And his disagreements in both Harris and Plessy show this fundamental difference in how they understood the power of the federal government in protecting civil rights. Harlan truly believed that the 14th Amendment gave Congress a wide range of authority to tackle racial discrimination, even when it was done by regular people, not the government.
So he saw the Reconstruction Amendments as much more powerful than the majority did in Harris.
Absolutely. And though Harlan's views didn't win out at the time, they paved the way for later civil rights advocates who kept pushing for a more inclusive understanding of the Constitution.
It's a reminder that legal interpretation isn't fixed. It changes over time. And those dissenting voices, they can plant the seeds for progress.
Absolutely. And even today, legal scholars still debate the merits of Harris and how it impacted civil rights law. Some say that the court's narrow interpretation of the Reconstruction Amendments helped create decades of Jim Crow and racial terror.
It's hard to argue with that, given how Harris limited federal intervention in cases of discrimination.
True. But others argue that the court in Harris was just following the rules of federalism and limited government, which are in the Constitution. They say the 14th Amendment was specifically meant for state actions, not what private individuals do.
So there's this ongoing debate about whether the court was just reading the Constitution as it was written or putting their own limits on federal power.
Right. It's a debate that really affects how we see the court's role in safeguarding civil rights.
This whole discussion brings up some huge questions that are still relevant today. About judicial activism, the balance of power in our government. It's fascinating.
Absolutely. United States v. Harris forces us to confront these fundamental questions and think about what they mean in our own time.
This deep dive into United States v. Harris has been incredibly insightful. Even though it was decided over a century ago, it still affects our legal landscape and our discussions about society today.
It really shows you how Supreme Court decisions can shape history and continue to have an impact for generations.
As we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with something to think about. Does Harris represent a failure of the Reconstruction Amendments to truly deliver on the promise of equal protection? Or is the problem more about how those amendments have been understood and used, sometimes falling short of their full potential?
That's a powerful question. I hope our listeners keep wrestling with it as they consider the complexities of United States v. Harris.
Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into United States v. Harris. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep those conversations going.